Hi, I'm James McElvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. Today we're talking to Nick Enfield, who is Professor of Linguistics at the University of Sydney in Australia. Nick has a very broad range of interests, extending from field research on Lao and other languages of mainland Southeast Asia to high linguistic and interactional theory. So that'd be questions like, what is language? How do we communicate? And how does this relate to human sociality? Nick's published too many books and papers to name in an introduction like this. But his next book is Life Cycles of Language, an Ecological and Evolutionary Framework, which will be coming out soon with MIT Press. And today we'll talk about one of the key topics in this book and a major question for linguistic theory, which is how do linguistic signs connect to concepts? So to get us started, Nick, what are the connections between linguistic signs and concepts? Or maybe another way of approaching this question would be to tell us how linguists have traditionally thought about these connections and what alternative approaches there might be.
Right, great. Well, that's a very big question with many parts to it. Linguistic signs, I guess, would be one thing you'd want to define or kind of problematize before you even start, because the word sign is so, it can mean so many things. But maybe a good place to start would be, as you mentioned, what linguists are kind of taught, if they're really taught anything about linguistic signs, and that would be the so-called Saussurean sign, where you have a signifier and a signified and some kind of relationship of standing for between them, right? So for me, when I studied undergrad linguistics, I guess I came across this most explicitly in Ron Lanica's work. So page one of his Foundations of Cognitive Grammar, he reproduces the famous diagram from Saussure's course that has, you know, these two poles. And often people will refer to that as the linguistic sign. And what I take that to mean is, you know, I think as most people would agree, on that reading of linguistic sign, you have a signifier standing for signified. And the signifier is, for example, the sound that you hear when someone pronounces a word, or a visual that you see when someone says something in sign language. And the signified would be some idea. Your question was about concepts. And so I think often people would say, well, the concept is embodied in the signified, the thing that the sign or the signifier stands for. So, you know, Saussure's example was the word tree, and, you know, you have the sound of the word tree, and that stands for something like a concept of a tree. And he represented that visually with a little tree cartoon. So most people, I think, would say that concepts fit in that signified box. They are the thing that word sound images or visual images stand for. And so learning words means learning those little packages of signifier-signifier mappings, right?
What does the concept consist in? Like, what actually is it? Is it a pattern of neurons firing in the brain? Is it some sort of platonic thing that exists in the world of forms? Or does it not really matter what it is, that we just postulate that there is a concept?
Well, what matters depends on sort of who you are and what question you're asking. And I think that, I suppose, like a good number of cognitive scientists, I would sort of take a stance that says at one level, anything to do with the mind, you know, language, concepts, all of these things, is going to involve something like neurons firing. Things happening physically in the brain. And, you know, one way to look at it is that ultimately everything can be reduced to physical happenings. Mm. Okay. But that is that's really not useful for most of what we do in language. Most of the time, what we want to do is talk about ideas and meanings and sort of ways of summarizing at a much higher level those physical happenings, partly because we couldn't, even if I describe to you what happens in my brain when I hear the word tree, it's not going to help you. It would be incomprehensible to you. I could have a printout of all the neurons of fire, and it would be very, very long, but it would be a finite set of actual, you know, if we had a magical measurements device, there would actually be an event that would correspond somehow to that, but it wouldn't help us to understand it. And so when we talk about concepts, we're really, it's not that concepts exist at another level, it's that we need another level at which we want to talk about concepts and make sense of them. Okay, so that's why we do things like diagram concepts, or we use paraphrase definitions of concepts, or, you know, we need to have some kind of meta representational means, whether it's, you know, as I said, meta language or visualization or something like that. And then, you know, that allows us to reflect on concepts, talk about them, try to explain them. So, but you asked, what do they consist in? And I think maybe this gives us a segue into perhaps what you were interested in talking about from your question. And that is, I want to say that concepts that are denoted by linguistic science are hypotheses.
Mm-hmm.
They're hypotheses about what people mean when they use those signs. And why do I say that? Well, because words exist at a population level. We have the sense that they have fixed meanings. We all know, of course, that they don't, and they're a bit slippery and negotiable, and they change over time. But as users of language, we trust the words we have to have, you know, somewhat fixed meanings. And yet, we have to actually construct what those words mean in our minds. You know, something about the neurons or what have you. But descriptively, we have to learn what those words mean, which is another way of saying we have to construct a representation of what we think that word means. So therefore, it's a hypothesis because you're constructing it, and it has to be consistent with the data. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean, if you're a language learner, you're faced with the examples of language use, and that's what I mean by the data. So you have experience with language. Every interaction you have involves, you know, people saying words and people responding to those words, and it's in those interactional sequences that you actually get data, you get evidence, you get feedback from how people respond to what other people say. A very simple example would be, you know, can you get me a glass of water? And someone goes and gets a glass of water, brings it back to the first person, and the first person seems satisfied. And so, you know, that might support your hypothesis that the sound water stands for that substance that was brought on the person. There's a lot of stuff to say about how that would actually work, but essentially, you know, the data are in the events of responding to signs in their usage, and the process of deciding what signifiers actually stand for is a process of hypothesizing what those words would mean, and the hypothesis needs to be consistent with the data. So I see, when I look at things like definitions, whether it's like Ray Jackendoff or Anna Vizbitska or somebody who would say, okay, I'm going to define what words mean and here's my formal explication, then, you know, they are giving a best guess. There is no kind of real meaning, but there's a very constrained set of possibilities precisely because we are all kind of subject to similar feedback and similar kind of incoming data on which to base our hypotheses of what words mean. And those are what linguistic concepts are.
Okay. But isn't there more to language and more to meaning than just this sort of simple coordinating of activity? Like, for example, you know, in lots of functional models of language, there are many, you know, lots of functional models of language will recognize some sort of coordination of activity, but then they will also hypothesize or postulate other uses of language. So one use that springs to mind is Malinowski's phatic communion, right? Where language is not used for any specific purpose, like it's aimless. It's just there to cultivate and maintain social relationships. And what you say is irrelevant.
Okay, so that's interesting. Well, firstly, I'd say there's a bit of a contradiction in what you said when you said it's not used for any purpose, and then you said what the purpose was.
Okay.
Which was to, you know, create a social connection or what have you. Okay, so...
Or not used to coordinate activity.
Right.
Yeah.
So coordinating activity is something very specific, but... So I guess if we just talk about third communion for a second.
Yeah.
So there is a purpose to the language use in that case. And so the classical frater communion would be, you know, let's talk about the weather or something like that. And then we, you know, I would sort of appeal to Robin Dunbar's work here on kind of language has a similar function to, you know, the physical grooming that primates carry out on each other. Why? Well, because it shows that people invest time in each other through the day, and then as an opportunity cost, which is to say I'm scratching your back, not the back of all these other individuals who I might be scratching. It's the same with language, where I'm talking to you, I spend more hours in the day talking with you and not to other people. But in reality, it's not the case that it doesn't matter what you talk about. Mm-hmm. So empirically, if you look at, you know, conversations that people have, they will cover quite particular topics. And this is, again, Robin Dunbar has shown quite interestingly how, you know, we have in our social circle different people at different distances from us in some sense. And people who've looked more closely at this from a conversation analytic point of view show, well, this is those distances between people, the social relationships that you forge through using language, are very often forged through quite specific topics that you would cover. So, for example, you would talk about like personal, physical, medical issues with certain people in your world. I mean, there's the doctor, okay? That's not what I mean. I mean, there's people like close to you where, you know, you'd be expected to reveal certain things. Like, let's say you have a, you know, diagnosis of a terrible disease. There's certain people who you should tell this, and there's certain order in which you should tell people. And these kinds of things are connected to those types of relationship functions. It's not clear that you tell them in order for them to do anything back. I mean, they will, of course, react in certain specific ways. Mm. But that kind of logic covers all sorts of things where, you know, we talk about the weather, we talk about, you know, what happened, you know, in the cricket, you know, or the rugby or whatever it is that we follow. And so I wouldn't say it doesn't matter what you talk about. And in fact, in some great sense, it doesn't matter what you talk about for the focus, for the function of frater communion. But in particular communities, there is actually, there are go-to topics that are the correct ones to talk about.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
So coming back to your question, you know, you were talking about coordinating activity, and I think there's a piece a bit missing in what I was saying earlier, which I haven't articulated yet, but I think you might have been getting to, which is that in that Saussurean view of a sign, you have this two-part sign. There's a signifier and a signified, and they're connected to each other. And that's a very static view of what meaning is, right? So it's just this disembodied thing that floats around. Maybe your brain is full of these little signified mappings. And I think that's exactly how it's viewed. Somehow they're stored in the brain and you've got these little mappings, and that's what it means to know a word. But if we go back to my point about, you know, words have consequences in real interaction, and those consequences are actually, you know, evidence for your ideas of what these things mean. Those consequences are, they're in the real world and they happen, and we refer to them, a certain class of those consequences, as interpretants.
Mm-hmm.
So in this chapter in the book that's forthcoming, I talk about sort of two axes along which you can think if you're thinking about what words sort of are and what they do. So one axis would be what I call the O axis, which is sign stands for object. And the word object here just means the same as signified in what we've been saying so far. So that's sort of, you know, this static relationship between a signifier and a signified. But there's this other relationship, which is the sign, the signifier, gives rise to some response that is interpretive, that makes sense insofar as it interprets what had just happened prior. So I gave the example of saying, give me a glass of water, and you walk off and get a glass of water and bring it, put it down. So my utterance, you know, we could map the meanings. We could say, well, here's all the grammatical constructions that we used here, all the words that we used. We've got all the meanings in our sort of mental lexicon. I can explain what that sentence means. But the other axis is this action, you refer to as kind of action coordination axis. So coordination of action in the sense that, you know, okay, I get you to do something for me, or we pick up a table and move it or something like that. That's a very important function of language. But interpretants in that general sense, I think, have a much broader set of functions than that. So if we are gossiping about a common someone we know, you know, in our village or what have you.
Well, which we were in fact doing before we started recording.
Right, yes. Yeah. So, you know, we're talking about particular individuals and that, you know, you may have some interpretants which were not expressed. You know, you might think, well, I don't know if I agree with what that guy said, or, oh, that guy has his mindset is more similar to mine than I thought, or, you know, oh, that confirms what I always suspected. So you might have a bunch of just interpretants which are not revealed. They're not public. But they're still interpretants in the sense that they are responses or reactions in some sense that make sense in terms of what the words actually stand for. It's really important to kind of make this distinction between interpretants of signs versus just reactions to signs. So this goes back to the kind of behaviorism versus cognitivism kind of argument, you know, and the cognitivist view of language says, okay, well, we have mental representations and that's how we know what words mean. And sort of pure hardcore behaviorism says, you know, oh no, there's just sort of stimulus and response. So I say, what are you, automatically go and grab a glass of water. Right? And I think both of those by themselves are insufficient, that both of them lack something. And that's my kind of pitch in that chapter. And it says, you know, if you say that a sign, a linguistic sign is just a signifier standing for a signified, well, you don't build in those responses that people have that somehow point to the meanings or help you hypothesize the meanings of words or help you test the meanings of words. You don't build that in. You'd have to sort of put that in from elsewhere. And similarly, or conversely, if your view of language is simply stimulus followed by response, well, that's insufficient to account for the data. You couldn't predict very well like what a person's response will be unless you know, somehow had a stabled idea of what words stand for. But my view is that the two things, the response to a sign and the kind of static kind of meaning that a sign has, those two things have to be aligned, and they're actually causally related in some important sense. And social coordination is just one type of thing that interpreters kind of can be realized as, but it's broader than that.
Okay. How does your model relate to the semiotic triangle, for example, you know, which I guess goes back to Ogden and Richards?
Everything I've just been saying
is
my kind of, I wouldn't say my interpretation, but it's what I have taken on from learning about Peirce's view of men.
Yeah.
And through my colleague, Paul Cockleman, who's a linguistic anthropologist at Yale, who's, you know, translated, shall we say, certain aspects of Peirce's kind of theory of meaning into it, to my mind, a much kind of more accessible kind of idiom. And that's really where I've drawn what I was just describing from, this triangle of sign, object, interpretant. I have to translate. So on that sign, in that, what I just said means signifier.
Yeah.
Object means signified, and interpretant is the third thing that was missing from the Saussurean kind of relationship. So what I'm talking about is one type of semiotic triangle.
Yeah, yeah.
Which specifically is, in the way that Paul Koppelman would describe it, would be to say a sign stands for an object insofar as it gives rise to interpretants that make sense insofar as they correspond to the same object as that sign.
Yeah.
And that is extremely powerful insight to my mind. And, you know, it's Paul Koppelman has certainly shown incredible mileage that one can get from it, but I've also found it very useful in thinking about things like how word meanings are learned, how social interaction relates to just semantic and grammatical knowledge, how languages, how language meanings can change over time.
Yeah.
What's the difference between linguistic concepts and just other kinds of concepts that don't have linguistic flavors? So, yeah, in terms of semiotic triangle, did you use that word?
That's the term I used. Yeah.
In terms of semiotic triangle, it is that's the word I use, is sign, object, and interpreter.
Yeah.
And those three things are kind of aligned with each other. It is powerful, and sometimes people might say that sort of model is too powerful, or it's sort of too all-encompassing, and maybe sometimes too, there's a certain vagueness to it as well. So when I first kind of learned about this view, thinking about meaning, I was often finding myself wanting to know, well, okay, in this bit of data or in this imagined situation, what is the interpreted? You know, but actually there's always multiple possible interpreters that can be true at the same time. So it's similarly going back to Peirce, you know, often what people talk about in relation to Peirce is this distinction between a kind of an iconic basis by which a signifier stands for a signified, or an indexical one, or a symbolic one. And then people want to know, okay, for this case, like a flag is waving in the breeze, you know, is this iconic, or is this indexical, or is this symbolic? And the answer is, well, you'll find all three if you look. It depends on how you're framing what you're looking at.
Yeah, yeah.
So a big piece of the important way to limit the kind of overpowerful nature of this model is to recognize that you as a kind of analyst are focusing on just very particular pieces of what is a buzzing, blooming kind of set of semiotic processes. And you know, that sort of begins to help, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so one impression I get from the sort of, from the examples that you give and the model that you sketch is it all sounds very calculating. You know, it's given in these, you know, evolutionary terms that, you know, we scratch other apes' backs so that they'll be our friends, and then, you know, and that we sort of are building up our power within the community. You know, so this model makes me think that we're reducing everything we do to trying to get food, you know, or trying to find a mate to carry on our genes. Have I got the wrong impression? But if I haven't got the wrong impression, is that model then a bit reductive? Like, isn't there more to life than getting food and getting a mate?
You know, that's a very reasonable thing to imply, for sure. And I certainly didn't suggest that there was nothing more to life than passing on one's genes. And so far we haven't discussed sort of evolutionary basis of this, but I subscribe to a view that is close to, I guess, the work by Marco Tomasello, where he's kind of trying to answer evolutionary questions and be very faithful to a kind of a Darwinian view of life, but at the same time, you know, embrace the facts that we are this deeply social species. You know, we have all sorts of altruism, we have all sorts of investment in social relationships, we have, you know, all sorts of investment in art and beauty and all of these things. And so I think his model of language or of communication more generally is really useful here. So he's kind of looking at what human communication is like from the point of view of, well, he's using development and evolution as a way to kind of get a window on what are the components of human communication. So he will look, for example, at young children, pre-linguistic infants, and sort of look at, well, how does their language develop in learning? And one of the really interesting insights is that he points out, well, there's really, you mentioned before something about, oh, well, language is not just about getting things, right? And so true. However, it kind of starts with that. Or this communication kind of starts with that, because you need stuff Right, so that we're all kind of subject to a, certain imperatives. And, we're I need water because I'm thirsty, am I, uncomfortable and all these things. So one of the earliest kind of functions that we use, for example, pointing gestures for, which is a very sort of foundational type of communicative act which generates interpretance, is getting stuff. I want that, give me that thing. But then... another function emerges, which is I'm pointing at something not because I want it, but because I think you want it. So you dropped your keys or you are looking for an object and you're not seeing it, and I might point to it. And so, those experiments show quite young kids will use communication to just inform others, not for them to get something, but to help the other person get something, right? And then the third kind of level is sharing. So it's not I want something, it's not you want something, it's wow, look at that sunset, or look at that amazing pink balloon, or this is a small child and it's looking at some fun thing to look at. So that's a really compelling kind of meta description of kind of three really foundational reasons to use language would be one way to put it. And I think then that, you can reframe that in terms of the types of interpretations that get that are elicited by three different kinds of action. So one is that, well, you do something that's good for me. Next one is, well, then you do something that's good for you. And then, the third one is, well, you do something that's good for the both of us together. It's a very simple kind of model, but I think a lot of what we do is really can be thought of through that lens. And you were just worried about reduction and reductionism and things like that. Maybe that this would be another version of some kind of reductionism, but I don't think so, because I think that model I just went through is looking at the foundations of kind of functional diversity and whatever it is that we do with language. And then, once you have those three kind of macro functions, well, you can flesh it out in as much detail as you want. Of course, once we've acquired a language, we have thousands, tens of thousands of words at our disposal. We have, with all the grammar in the world to use them in unique and novel ways.
Yeah. Okay. One last question. The model that you've sketched is basically a sort of causal model. I mean, you've even used the term causal when you've talked about, how concepts are formed in the mind and so on. But you've also, pointed out that there are many different kinds of interpretance,
yeah.
And the analyst can come up with different interpretance, and the analyst doesn't know if those are the particular interpretance that the people actually involved in the interactional situation have come up with themselves. So I wonder if the starting point is really like understanding, in a hermeneutic sense, rather than, trying to come up with a positivistic model of how meaning works. And, what occurs to me here is like Diltai, the fundamental difference between the humanities and the natural sciences is the humanities, start with understanding as, as a hermeneutic process. And the natural sciences are the ones that seek these causal explanations. And these are two different realms.
Yeah, I find that I don't really want to subscribe to that distinction, because I think that both sides that you've set up there are kind of doing both things. So, in what we're doing as analysts, but also as participants in social life, is making interpretations, best guesses, abductive kind of, best guesses as to what's happening, based on evidence. We're not just doing random stuff. Even in the most kind of humanities-oriented...
Although I think Diltai would object to the charge that understanding is doing random stuff.
Oh, sure.
A method, but it's a different kind of method from seeking causal explanations.
I didn't want to imply that he meant that at all. But what I mean is that, whether you're a scientist or something else, you're having to come up with best guesses as to what's going on, which is an interpretive type of process, And you're doing so based on evidence that you're they have in front of you, which is, you know, an empirical kind of, well, you used the word positivist just before?
Positivist was the word I used, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, related to that kind of thing. So I think one of the questions that comes up often is, it's quite a lot deep problem actually with just linguistic analysis, is where's the interpretation going on here? Because we're looking at a situation where someone is doing some interpreting, but we as analysts are also doing some interpreting. So it's quite messy if people are very often kind of mixing these things up. So no, it is an example that I kind of like, which is something like this. So, you know, imagine that you're in Russia and there's a car crash occurs and a car rolls and it's a terrible smash. And, you know, the Russian people go over to the car to check if the person inside is all right. And they lean in and the person says, "Water!" Right? And then so three Russian people, one of them goes, "He's alive." You know, and the other one goes, "Well, he's an Englishman." And the other one runs and gets some water. Right, so these would be three quite different interpretations, right? So one is like, so of the same behavior. So the behavior was pronouncing this word. And we can see the fact that person one said he's alive, that's our evidence for how he interpreted this. Well, put it another way. That act was an act of interpretation of the man's pronouncing the word water. And it was relevant to the situation. This guy's just had a car wreck, right? Is he dead or alive? Well, now I have evidence that he's alive. He spoke. He pronounced the word. And so our evidence as analysts that he made that interpretation is in that act, which I would call an act of interpretation. And why is it interpreted? Because it makes sense in terms of what the man in the car wreck, what his action stands for. Not that the word water stands for some water, but the behavior of producing a word stands for this is a living human being, right? As opposed to a dead human being can't pronounce words. Similarly, for the second person, he's an Englishman. The word water is English. So it's irrelevant what it stands for, but what's important is that it's recognized as an English word and that person sees that. So the second guy is like, again, by saying he's an Englishman, it's an active interpretation. That response is an active interpretation of the sign. But again, it's selecting something different about the sign. The first was selecting that this is a physical behavior that requires a living body. The second, by selecting a different thing, which is that I recognize that as an English word. And the third, the guy goes and gets water, is orienting to the meaning of the actual word. And so it's only in the third of those that the concept part that we started this conversation out with is actually evoked, shall we say. But all of those three things would be interpreted in a complete full sense that I want to mean it, that they just they point to really quite different kinds of things. And coming back to your question, they all involve interpretation based on evidence in the scene by the three people that I just described, and then secondly by us when we talk about this these events. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, thank you very much for answering those questions.
Thanks very much.